I felt overall there was a very genial sort of atmosphere. I also was utterly shocked by the amount of gay clergy I saw. it was stunning. I was like, I feel like I'm like at, you know, Fire Island or P-Town or something. There's just so many gay people here.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Cayman's lawmakers rush to prevent couples equality. A pen friend lauds a lesbian writer's legacy. And human spirit meets Holy Spirit at the Anglican Lambeth Conference. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Lee Moore.
And I'm Chris Wilson.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 13th, 2008. An amendment to legislation in the Cayman Islands defining marriage as between a man and a woman was approved this week by the British Territory's Legislative Assembly. Civil partnerships, giving same-gender couples most of the rights of marriage, took effect in the UK in late 2005, but the legislation did not extend to any of Britain's 14 territories, which include Gibraltar, the Falkland Islands, and the Caymans. None of them have moved to grant legal recognition to same-gender couples. Cayman opposition parties are calling for the law to be extended to ban civil partnerships. They fear the UK or the European Union may impose them at some point in the future. But leader of government business Kurt Tibbetts told the Caymanian Compass newspaper that if we were to define civil unions, it would mean we would condone them and accept them and allow them, he said, and I'm saying otherwise. Lesbi-gay issues have had a higher profile in the Caymans since May, when a U.S. tourist vacationing at the Royal Palms Resort was detained by an off-duty police officer for kissing his boyfriend. He was taken to the police station, reportedly, after other customers complained. The man was later released without charge, and the director of tourism sent a formal apology to him. But Tibbetts said while the Caymans welcome all tourists, the basis of this bill is not financial calculations. We don't set our family values based on how much money they make for us. Homosexual acts between consenting adults were decriminalized in the Caymans by a UK order in council in December 2000. The UK and the Caymans are due to begin talks about constitutional reform later this month.
A Lebanese woman and her Bulgarian partner, who were arrested when others complained about their making out on a beach in Dubai, were jailed for a month in early September after the Dubai Court of Appeal upheld a lower court ruling. They were convicted of committing indecent acts in public for kissing and fondling each other on Al Mamzar Beach. The local 7 Days newspaper said that the women will be deported after they serve their jail terms, and noted that this was the first case of its kind in the United Arab Emirates, a federation of 7 city-states that includes Dubai. While it's a popular destination for tourists, and a majority of its 5.6 million residents are foreigners, Dubai is governed by Islamic law, and homosexual acts are a criminal offense. At least 40 men were arrested there in July for what Dubai's police chief called not respecting social values and behaving like the opposite sex.
Posters advocating death to gays appeared around Sarajevo, Bosnia-Herzegovina, in early September in advance of the nation's first lesbi-gay pride activities. 3 days of events are scheduled to begin on September 24th. They happen to coincide with the Muslim holy month of Ramadan and have been angrily denounced by some imams and politicians as immoral and contrary to the teachings of the Quran. Sarajevo is at least 85% Muslim. The posters were condemned by local human rights activists. One of Sarajevo's leading intellectuals, law professor Dragov Grebo, told the Associated Press that the organizers should have taken Muslim concerns into consideration. "Why this finger right in the eye?" he asked. However, he said, it's not a reason to cancel it. Bosnia-Herzegovina is not in the European Union, although it's seeking membership. But the EU has called sexual orientation-based discrimination in the country widespread.
A cabaret featuring performers from London, Amsterdam, and Berlin is scheduled to run throughout 5 days of Pride events in the coming week in Serbia's capital of Belgrade, according to a report by pinknews.com. Organizers are only using a website to communicate details about each event for safety reasons, an indication of the climate for the country's LGBT people. A large group of neo-fascist and religious fundamentalists violently attacked marchers during Belgrade's first-ever Pride parade in 2001. A subsequent event was canceled because organizers couldn't guarantee participant safety. This year's Pride website says, "We have a new concept. We refuse to spend time on worries about violence that might happen and hiring private security or police." Serbia, which is not in the European Union, is one of the continent's least accepting of LGBT people, according to a European Commission report on human rights published last year.
But annual LGBT Pride festivities kicked off in Taiwan's capital city of Taipei this week and will culminate with Asia's largest Pride march on September 27th. Last year's parade drew about 15,000 people, and organizers are expecting up to 20,000 this year. About 500 people marched in Taipei's first Pride parade in 2002. Among several Pride-related events, an online essay contest is being held with the title of My Gay Friend. Government officials will select 5 winning entries and include them in a booklet on lesbi-gay life in Taipei, which the city plans to publish annually. Compared to most of its Asian neighbors, social acceptance of gays and lesbians in Taiwan has grown considerably in this decade, most notably in Taipei. While activists remain frustrated over stalled national equality legislation, a number of LGBT cafes and bookstores are reportedly flourishing in the city.
In the U.S., a Florida judge has ruled that the state's 31-year ban on adoptions by gays and lesbians is unconstitutional. The decision by Judge David Odlin Jr. will allow an openly gay Key West man to adopt the teenage boy that he's raised as a foster parent since 2001. Odlin appointed the foster father to be the boy's legal guardian in 2006. The teen has learning disabilities and special needs, so it's unlikely that a heterosexual couple would want him. At a hearing earlier this year, according to a report in the Miami Herald, the boy testified that he wanted the man to be his forever father because I love him. Judge Odlin said that the adoption by the Key West man and his partner was in the child's best interests. He said that barring gays and lesbians from adopting conflicted with the state constitution because it targets a specific group and prevents family courts and child welfare judges from deciding on a case-by-case basis what's best for the child. The law was passed during Anita Bryant's infamous anti-queer crusade in 1977. Attempts to repeal it have failed several times in the legislature. Odlin's ruling, however, is unlikely to be cited as a precedent in future cases. And if it is, legal analysts say, it's likely to be appealed. Mississippi is the only other U.S. state that specifically forbids gays and lesbians from adopting children.
Maryland's highest court, the State Court of Appeals, this week ruled against a referendum proposing to repeal gender identity anti-bias protections in Montgomery County, which is just north of Washington, D.C. The Montgomery County Council voted unanimously last year to add gender identity as a protected class to its civil rights law. Charging that the addition of gender identity would create confusion in public restrooms and health club locker rooms, Citizens for Responsible Government immediately began collecting signatures to block the statute from going into effect. This week's Court of Appeals decision reversed a lower court ruling that the LGBT advocacy group Equality Maryland had missed the deadline to challenge the validity of the petition signatures that had qualified the measure for the ballot. The High Court heard arguments on September 8th and had to rule quickly because state officials were required to certify language for the November 4th ballot by September 10th. The justices only issued a brief order reversing the lower court ruling, promising a fuller explanation of the decision later. Lambda Legal had joined Equality Maryland in the lawsuit. Natalie Chin, a Lambda Legal staff attorney, told reporters that the bottom line is that the court said a petition sponsor shouldn't be allowed to cut corners and circumvent legal requirements to get a referendum attacking minority protections on the ballot. We are very happy that this duly enacted law can take effect and protect a vulnerable group of Montgomery County residents.
Mexico City's legislature passed a law earlier this month making it easier for transgender people to legally change their names and obtain revised birth certificates reflecting their chosen gender identity. Laws had already allowed people to do that, but because there were no specific rules, the process could take years to wind through the courts. The new law formalizes the procedure for name changes and lets people ask a judge for new birth certificates. Mexico City's leftist government last year enacted civil unions legislation for same-gender couples.
And finally, a church in South Africa has been fined for firing a music teacher in 2005 because he was in a gay relationship. The country's Christian Democratic Party and the Apostolic Faith Mission Church have expressed alarm over the recent Pretoria High Court ruling. Officials from the party and the church said that while the South African Constitution prohibits discrimination based on sexual orientation, it also protects freedom of association and religion, and that the former should not trump the latter. Apostolic Faith President Dr. Isaac Berger told reporters that Christian values should not be subject to an extremely secular and liberal constitution, that is, he said, above the Bible and God. But the court ruled that the Dutch Reformed Church Moreletta Park had discriminated against Johan Strydom, must publicly apologize to him, and must pay him the equivalent of about $11,200 for impairment of his dignity, emotional and psychological suffering, and loss of earnings. While expressing its disagreement with the ruling, the church said this week that it had decided not to appeal because the congregation had enough opportunity to testify on the Bible's view on the dangers of homosexuality.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 13, 2008, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Lee Moore.
And I'm Chris Wilson.
The lesbian scientist who cured thousands of Africans and the sexy and not-so-sexy sides of a big bishop's bash. Later in the program. In this portrait of a friendship, This Way Out queer lit commentator Janet Mason pays tribute to the life and work of lesbian author Toni Brown.
A true friend is hard to lose. The loss is palpable, like some previously unknown core at the center of you is suddenly ripped out, howling and empty. This is how I felt when my good friend, the lesbian writer Toni Brown, died on April 17, 2008. She was 55 years old. Toni and I were close friends for nearly 20 years. We met several years before she moved to Philadelphia. At the time, she lived in Amherst, Massachusetts, and was a member of a Northampton lesbian writers group. We met through a mutual friend who was in the Philadelphia Feminist Writers Group with me at the Outright Conference, an LGBT writing conference held at that time in Boston. A year or so later, my Philadelphia writing group went to Northampton to give a reading. I stayed at Toni's house in Amherst and took her large, gentle German shepherd named Zen for a walk. Zen led me into the garden at the Emily Dickinson house, where he made a reservation for the two writing groups, now one large group, at least for the duration of our stay. I remember all of us sitting in the large Victorian sitting room. The drapes were drawn, and there was a hush surrounding the words of the tour guide, who carefully left out any mention of Emily's lesbian passions. Now, reflecting back on that afternoon, I see that there was something prophetic about it. We were surrounded by the ghostly presence of Emily Dickinson, even as we laughed and posed for pictures. At the same time that the pictures were taken in the Dickinson garden some 20 years ago, Toni had a short afro. A year later, when she moved to Philadelphia, she began locking her hair, always, it seemed, twisting the tiny nubs until they grew down below her shoulders. Toni's work was published in Sinister Wisdom, Prairie Schooner, and the American Poetry Review, among other places. Her words are the quiet hush around the storm, a keen and often painful observation of detail, insight into injustice in its many forms, and at the same time a testament to love, to all that is good in the world. Her work is transcendent, just as Toni was in her life. I cannot stop my mind from trying to search for answers or for meaning. One thing that I am certain of is that I was fortunate to have Toni Brown for my friend. Several summers ago, we spent time together in Provincetown, Massachusetts, a favorite place for both of us, and especially for Toni, who grew up in Boston. One night we found a karaoke drag bar, the audience filled with primarily straight couples, for some reason, and the two of us got up to sing California Dreaming. As we stood back to back, our shoulders touching as we turned our heads to look at each other as we sang. Later that year, in the fall, we gave our last reading together with women from Tony's old writing group at an art gallery in Northampton, Massachusetts. Members of the Philadelphia Writers Group had gone our separate ways, falling out of touch because of our busy schedules. But suddenly, we are back in each other's lives. We tell the old stories and look at the old photos of our trip to Northampton 20 years ago, when we stood in Emily Dickinson's garden so happy with ourselves and with each other. When we look at the photos and see our younger selves with a younger Tony, with her short afro, we are looking at someone who is now absent. She is the part of our laughter that is gone. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
Dr. Louise Pierce, renowned woman scientist of her time, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Louise Pierce was born in Massachusetts in 1885 and was one of the first women to earn a degree in physiology. She earned her medical degree from Johns Hopkins 5 years later. Pierce was one of the leading women scientists of the early 20th century. She traveled to the Belgian Congo with drugs she'd helped develop to treat African sleeping sickness. She tested it on 70 patients with miraculous results. The drug eradicated the parasitic disease within weeks, eliminating symptoms and restoring general health in even extreme cases, curing over 100,000 Africans. Belgian officials awarded her the Ancient Order of the Crown of Belgium. Pierce spent her last years in New Jersey sharing a home with author Ida A.R. Wiley and noted New York City health physician Josephine Baker. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Mary Gay Hutcherson.
Hello, this is the actor Michael Emerson. I play Ben on Lost. It's not easy being one of the others. So if time travel or moving the island isn't an option and you're feeling sort of lost, try listening to Greg and Lucia on This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
You'll find a new This Way Out update in your email inbox soon with news about podcasts and altered states. If you're not signed up to get it, email tworadio@aol.com.
I went to the Lambeth Conference where I got to see a lot of bishops wearing very colorful frocks.
Last time on This Way Out, ex gay activist and performance artist Peterson Toscano gave a rousing description of the once-a-decade Lambeth Conference of Anglican Bishops. That mid-August gathering in England was expected to be a make-or-break event for the worldwide Anglican Communion. The 2004 consecration of openly gay Bishop of New Hampshire Gene Robinson and the blessing of same-gender couples in Canada and the U.S. have been the main targets of schism-threatening conservatives in the church. In the conclusion of his conversation with Heather Kitching, Toscano shares more about the human approach that transformed a potentially explosive situation.
And how did the media coverage and the fact that Lambeth was happening affect the public discourse? I mean, aside from the media coverage, what about, you know, talk show debates, letters to the editor? Were you seeing a lot of public debate happening around the whole thing?
Yeah, I couldn't help but notice it even when I was in Guernsey, and even in their little local paper there, there were articles, there were letters about Lambeth. It is the Church of England, and so it affected, even though a lot of people don't attend the Church of England, it definitely was an English story that was very much in the press. There were always letters to the editors, always opinion pieces in the papers. Anytime I saw the news, there was something about what was going on at Lambeth. So it really captured the attention of people there. And when I was even going through immigration at one point, coming back from Guernsey, and they're like, "Why are you here?" I was like, "Well, I'm here for the Lambeth Conference." And they're like, "Wow, are you a bishop?" I'm like, "Yeah, right."
Wow. So did you actually attend any of Robinson's events? I mean, you said that you had competing events one day, but did you get to see any of the speeches that he made?
No, because he only had that one that I that was at the same time that I was there was when we had the competing event. Other than that, I you know, a lot of his were closed door sort of things where he was meeting with people, and he actually had lots of conversations with individual bishops, which was great because things happened on campus, but things happened off campus too, and it was not surprising to see bishops down in Canterbury walking around the streets and all. So he had events with folks there. But what I got to witness was, again, like I said, these other folks, some of whom have been preparing for this event for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were groups there that, you know, had themselves together. They were communicating with people. They were lobbying. They were connecting. They were trying, you know, working hard to persuade people to listen to their stories. And I think they had a great impact, much more than the media covered and is aware of.
Mm-hmm. Was there much of an anti-gay presence there? I mean, as you pointed out, a lot of the anti-gay folks chose to forego the event, but did many come?
I think it was pretty clear the most anti-gay people chose not to come. And so as a result, you had some more moderate people or just people who were just like, why are we even talking about this issue when there's so much poverty going on and there's AIDS and there's other stuff that we need to be talking about? There was also a lot of talk. I mean, this wasn't just about the ordination of gays that was an issue. It was ordination of women was another big issue. There was a whole day about women's issues and spousal abuse and discussions about things like that. So I felt overall there was a very genial sort of atmosphere. I also was utterly shocked by the amount of gay clergy I saw. it was stunning. I was like, I feel like I'm like at, you know, Fire Island or, you know, or P-Town or something. There's just so many gay people here. And it was really, really stunning. And it's one thing I said recently to a clergy member who's anti-gay. I said, you know, I know you push us out of your churches, but like it or not, we're still having church with or without your permission. And without openly ordaining us, there are still plenty of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people serving in the Anglican Church.
Mm-hmm. So what was your sense of what the outcome was at the Lambeth Conference? I mean, did you have a sense that they did discuss the gay issue in detail, and did they come to some kind of resolution after, you know, there's been such a lead up to this for so many months and years that this was going to be the big showdown about queer issues? You know, has there been a resolution?
Yeah, it didn't. I mean, there's nothing decisive that was done. I think one thing that did happen, and again, it's not particularly sexy, but relationships were built. And, you know, at the bottom line, that's the most important thing in any kind of activism, that you build relationships, that people get humanized on both ends of the struggle. And this is going to go on. And I think people heard stuff that was difficult to hear. You know, about churches who in Nigeria that were threatened to be bombed because Gene Robinson was ordained as a bishop when that happened. And you know, just because that there were so many anti-gay forces in that city that they thought, well, this is an anti-gay institution, and people's lives were at risk because of that. And that's not a part of the story that we often hear in this, that there are local challenges that people face that, you know, that can really affect them. So I think people got to have a chance to have a good hearing of a lot of the issues, and it's incredibly complex, and I don't think they're going to come to a quick conclusion at any time soon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just going to be further talking, further waiting, and hopefully some intervisitation that will happen so that some more of the American clergy will go to parts of Africa and South America. And it's funny because I'm a Quaker, and we have a very similar struggle globally. I mean, a lot of people think Quakers are like, wow, they're the cool people that welcome everybody in. But there are evangelical Quaker churches in North America, in Africa, in South America, that are not welcoming yet of gays and lesbians. Some are, but many of them are not. And we're having the same struggle, and people are saying, should we not associate with these people anymore? What do we do? And as a result, there's been a big inter-visitation campaign where people are visiting each other's meeting and sitting and talking and getting face-to-face with our opponents and seeing that, hey, they're people like we're people. And I think that's so critical in the work of activism, so that we're not always demonizing the other.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So what are you planning your own activism out of this, or are you planning to follow up in any way from this trip?
Well, I'm not an Anglican, so it's really kind of funny that I was invited in the first place. I never, you know, pursued it. It was a personal friend of Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who had seen me perform and said, it would be great if you can come to Lambeth. And this was 3 years ago. And I was like, sure, if you want me. And I really thought he was just chatting me up. You know, I was just like, yeah, whatever. And then, you know, in the fall, I got, you know, the email saying, we're ready to make arrangements for you to come. So I felt honored to be part of that, but I don't feel personally a part in the Anglican worldwide community. But I think it has helped to reinforce the idea of what I do with BeyondXGay.com and the work that we're doing working with ex-gay survivors, that ultimately the best data that we can provide for anyone is our own story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so powerful when we can vulnerably, clearly tell our story. And I keep on thinking of the words of Langston Hughes' poem, I Too, where he talks about how he wasn't allowed to sit at the table and sent to eat in the kitchen. And this is a man who's a black man living in a very white America, but also a gay man living in a very straight America. And the very end of the line, end of the poem, he says, besides, they'll see how beautiful we are and be ashamed. And I think ultimately that is what's going to happen in these churches that are so intolerant. They're going to see their own sons and daughters who are lesbian and gay and see the beauty in them. And they're going to turn. And, of course, not all do. And it's at their own loss and poverty. But more and more, I think we're seeing that. And I think that, more than anything else, is moving people along, just seeing what we bring to the church, what we bring to our communities, that we're not who they've been told we were. They've been given misinformation. We can counter those lies with the truth of our lives.
That was ex-gay activist performer Peterson Toscano talking about the Anglican Bishops Lambeth Conference with This Way Out correspondent Heather Kitching. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Lee Moore, Chris Wilson, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Janet Mason, Judd Proctor, and Brian Burns with Mary Gay Hutcherson, and Heather Kitching contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is supported by charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep us on the air. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of all our programs there. To receive our weekly email alerts or the next This Way Out update, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on CJAM Windsor, Ontario, WZKW Kingsville, Ohio, KBOO Portland, Oregon, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all gonna stay tuned.